Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on May 25th, 2019. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Agantuka Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha uses the metaphor of a common residence to show that the Eightfold Path is a true refuge for anyone seeking to develop the profound understanding of the nature of stress and suffering and gain insight into the three marks of existence. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. Today's talk is on the Agantuka Sutta, which is another sutta, but perhaps one of the most direct sutta, where the Buddha emphasizes that the only path that he teaches to awakening is the Eightfold Path. And throughout the suttas, that's the prevalent theme. The Buddha never taught anything else other than this Eightfold Path. But you can sense from even the need for this particular sutta that within the Buddha's Sangha, the original Sangha, there was still this fabricated need to adapt, accommodate, and embellish his teachings. So he taught this. And again, this is a common theme. The Buddha's words, "Friends, I will teach the value of developing direct knowledge and profound wisdom. Listen carefully. Suppose there is a guest house where people from all directions and all professions and positions take residence. In this same way, anyone who cultivates and methodically practices the Noble Eightfold Path will comprehend with direct knowledge and profound wisdom whatever phenomena are to be comprehended with direct knowledge and profound wisdom." In other words, this isn't a vague and general practice of understanding all of creation and all those great questions that men have always had, men and women, people have always had. The phenomena that are to be comprehended starts narrowing our focus. And of course, in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths, we know what the Buddha is referring to as the three marks of existence. And that reference to the guest house, which could be a little bit confusing because there's no other reference in this sutta to that metaphor, it simply means that in a guest house, people come from all different directions and all different positions, and they come together, in this case, to take up residence for shelter. The metaphor is that from people from all different directions, all different positions, without any distinction as to class, because this was important during the Buddhist time, and I think it's still somewhat important today, as long as you come and take residence within the Eightfold Path or take refuge within the Eightfold Path, you are an authentic Dhamma practitioner, united. We talked a little bit about this on retreat, excuse me. And it happens here too. One of the things that was interesting on this retreat, maybe a little bit different, is we did get into a discussion one evening that excited a few people, including me, properly and mindfully so. And it was a situation that people can have very differing positions on, very differing views. And that came out. But the one thing that didn't change was the unity in our Sangha. And it's because we are established not on something speculative, not on something that we'd like the Dhamma practice to be. People that come here agree that we're coming here to learn the Eightfold Path and the Buddha's teachings. And nothing else. When you have that point of focus, point of unification, then other things simply don't matter. But it takes that focus. And that's a good example of how a well-focused Sangha works, but also how a well-focused mind works. It's really a matter of establishing seclusion, as Lorna talks about really eloquently a few times, that we don't just establish our seclusion on our cushion during meditation, but that well-concentrated mind allows us to take that seclusion off our cushion and be in the world, but our mind is secluded. We're not affected by it because we have unified ourselves with the Eightfold Path. The Buddha's words. "Furthermore, they will abandon whatever phenomena are to be abandoned through direct knowledge and profound wisdom." Okay. No ambiguity is there. We will understand what we are supposed to hold in mind as authentic Dhamma practitioners and what we are supposed to realize as mere distraction and mere fabrication and let it go. Furthermore, they will experience whatever phenomena are to be experienced through direct knowledge and profound wisdom. What is the experience to be experienced?
The present moment.
Wow. Yes, thank you. And to achieve that present moment, the experience is the Eightfold Path. The phenomena of the Eightfold Path, we talked a little bit about this too, and I won't get too deep into it, but the phenomena, the Eightfold Path is a fabricated path in that it is developed within a fabricated view, but so that we can see that. You often hear me say, especially on retreat, but even here, we have to learn, we have to meet people where we are. We have to meet ourselves where we are. And so it takes something fabricated to see a fabricated view. The point of that is that upon awakening, we live within the framework of the Eightfold Path, but it's not necessarily a constant consideration. It's simply something we've developed. You can say that we've reconditioned our minds from a fabricated view to a view that is based solely on reality. I'm going to read that again because it might make a little more sense. Furthermore, they will experience whatever phenomena are to be experienced through direct knowledge and profound wisdom. Furthermore, they will develop whatever phenomena are to be developed through direct knowledge and profound wisdom. Again, that what we're to develop is insight into the three marks of existence. And which phenomena are to be comprehended with direct knowledge and profound wisdom? Now the Buddha is referring to the five clinging aggregates: the form aggregate, the feeling aggregate, the perception aggregate, the mental fabrication aggregate, and the consciousness aggregate. These five clinging aggregates are the phenomena to be comprehended with direct knowledge and profound wisdom. What do the five clinging aggregates represent? This is a test.
Confusion.
Anatta.
Looking at the world in the wrong way.
Yes, yes. It is just that. Ultimately, the Buddha's internet connection is unstable. There seems to be, because we have developed a fabricated view of self that is attached to every thought, word, and idea that has ever occurred to us, and that's an ongoing process of maintaining anatta, it seems like such a complex matter to even address that issue, doesn't it? How can we do this? I was talking to another new person the other day, and he says, I'm really scared about this idea of letting go of all these views. What happens to me? It's such a common question. What happens to us as we develop the Dhamma is we let go of every single view that we've created, self-created views, that are causing greed, aversion, and deluded thinking in our own lives. So we're not letting go of anything of any value at all. In fact, you could say the things that we're holding on to devalue every single minute that we live. But we don't recognize it because it's so close to us. The five clinging aggregates are the description of that ongoing confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. So the ultimate, and the five clinging aggregates are the personal experience of a misunderstanding of impermanence and not self-characteristic and the resulting suffering. So when the Buddha is referring to gaining insight into phenomena, meaning the five clinging aggregates, he's always also referring to those three marks of existence.
I was just going to say it's easier to do with things that are troubling than it is with things that are joyful, because you have to hold on to that.
Yep. And there's even a very subtle aspect of societal condition to do that, and this has to do with this the positive thinking bubble that we're all supposed to live under, that life is always wonderful if you don't ever look at any negative. And so that relates to, okay, I'll let go of all this stuff I don't like, but you know, a couple of cigarettes a day and maybe a couple of glasses of vodka and 4 hours of television, I'm going to hang on to that because that makes me feel good. What could be wrong with that? It feels good. And I'm using somewhat extreme examples, but whatever we were attaching ourselves to simply because it sounds like a positive view is a fabricated view, isn't it? Because life, the Buddha hit us all between the eyes when he states the first noble truth is suffering occurs, dukkha occurs. Why is that so profound? So we start immediately to let go of this fabricated view that everything has to be positive or has an underlying positive component to it. Things aren't that way. Things are painful and they're pleasurable. That's just life. But when we start attaching ourselves to what's pleasurable and creating aversion, which is known as greed, and create aversion over the things we don't like, what are we doing? We're insisting that we don't want this life. And yet we're compelled to live it, aren't we, from one point to another point. The Buddha realized that too, and he said, there's got to be a way that I can live from birth to death in peace and freedom. And he figured it out. It's by not wanting anything to be different. And that initial thought was, well, wait a minute, what about all these problems in the world? Dukkha occurs. And it doesn't mean that we're not concerned about it. In fact, as we deepen our wisdom and understanding, we're able to be concerned about the world without being averse to it. And that's a person that can make some tremendous differences in the world, true differences. And the Buddha proved that. And many other people have, by the way. And I'm not saying that we need to be awakened before we can have any positive effect. We all have a positive effect on the people closest to us and our initial environment. That only grows as we deepen our understanding. In which phenomena are to be abandoned with direct knowledge and profound wisdom? Ignorance and craving for becoming further ignorant. That relates directly to dependent origination, doesn't it? From ignorance comes suffering. Ignorance and craving for becoming further ignorant are the phenomena to be abandoned with direct knowledge and profound wisdom. It kind of makes sense, too, doesn't it? A simple and direct path. If my problems are rooted in ignorance of something, then what I'd like to do if I want to let go of those issues is to develop understanding or wisdom. And it's just that way. And so this simple eightfold path is the path to go from, to recognize and abandon ignorance and develop profound wisdom of a very specific topic, Four Noble Truths. And the fourth noble truth is the truth of the path leading to the cessation of the first noble truth, suffering. And which phenomena are to be experienced with direct knowledge and profound wisdom? So the Buddha states that there is dukkha, the first noble truth. Craving originates and clinging perpetuates that suffering. The third noble truth is that cessation of that suffering is possible and can be experienced. And the fourth noble truth is the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So the phenomena to be experienced with direct knowledge and profound wisdom is knowledge with regards to stress. Simple and direct. And release from ignorance of four noble truths are the phenomena to be experienced with direct knowledge and profound wisdom. And which phenomena are to be developed with direct knowledge and profound wisdom? A calm mind and insight into three marks of existence are the phenomena to be developed with direct knowledge and profound wisdom. So even this awakened mind, resting in calm, it's still a phenomena, isn't it? Why is that important? Because it's a fluid state. Even in an awakened, fully mature mind, that mind is still in the environment of impermanence. And so that fourth foundation of mindfulness, the quality of mind, is something to be mindful of. And it's a benchmark or a signpost onto what we're holding in mind. And if what we're holding in mind is confusing or distracting or troubling or exciting in some way, we've fallen back into eye-making. We've fallen back, even if it's just momentarily, into ignorance of Four Noble Truths, even if it's just momentarily. So the question I can see, I would bet in all your minds and mine, I'm being a little confused, how can an awakened mind fall back into it? And a truly awakened mind won't fall back into that ignorance, but along the way, we have that signpost of a troubled mind state showing us that we're not quite there yet. There's something missing. And that's what this sutta is teaching too. If you're not there, recognize it this way. And if you're not there, the Buddha answers the question. And how does anyone who cultivates and methodically practices the Noble Eightfold Path through direct knowledge and profound wisdom comprehend appropriate phenomena, abandon appropriate phenomena, experience appropriate phenomena, and develop appropriate phenomena? Anyone who develops right view, dependent on seclusion, which is the same thing as saying dependent on jhana, on a well-concentrated mind, and also on a meditation practice that provides that initial seclusion, meaning a sitting practice, not some of the other practices that have been developed, dependent on seclusion and dispassion and on cessation of ignorance that results in release from wrong views. Through direct knowledge and profound wisdom, they develop right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation that is dependent on seclusion, dependent on dispassion, dependent on cessation that results in release from clinging to wrong views. In this way, anyone who cultivates and methodically practices the Noble Eightfold Path will, with direct knowledge and profound wisdom, comprehend phenomena to be comprehended, abandon phenomena to be abandoned, and experience phenomena to be experienced, and develop the phenomena to be developed. That's the end of the sutta. That last line, again, is a reference and encouragement back to recognize that there's phenomena to be developed. What phenomena? A calm and peaceful mind. Mm-hmm. The abandonment of ignorance. That's all phenomena, isn't it? Anything that occurs in the physical, natural world is phenomena. It arises and passes away. Whether it's just a fleeting thought, that's still a phenomena. Or a mountain, a granite mountain is a phenomena, slowly eaten away by the environment. So this simple and direct teaching is, again, an encouragement to all of us as Dhamma practitioners to remain focused on the Eightfold Path. And that's the path to wisdom and understanding and a calm and peaceful mind. That's my conclusion to that. Any questions related directly to this sutta?
I have a question.
Please.
Comment. By seclusion, he's not talking about physically secluding yourself in a closet. He's physically talking about secluding your mind from the... from reacting to everything. Look at it, know what's happening, but don't fly off the handle.
Yes, it's exactly that. Thank you. Yeah, contrary to popular beliefs, the Buddha never said that we should spend years in a cave or anything like that. People have developed great insight, I think, sitting in caves. But the Buddha didn't talk about that. He was interested in finding a way that we could live in the world with a mind united with its body, moment by moment, without any reason to leave our body or leave what's occurring in the present moment. And certainly secluding ourselves from the world is just that. It's not that. It's about being in the world but completely disentangled from the world. And that rest and that seclusion that we develop, excuse me, on our meditation cushion, but with the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, we're able to take that seclusion established on our meditation cushion and bring it off our cushion and into the world with us. So that way of living in the world but not being affected of the world and affected by the world is simply that. And we are much more effective and much more present moment by moment, no matter what's occurring. And there's a remarkable occurrence that takes place from seeing a situation completely differently than you used to. Mm-hmm. And you know it. It's almost like there's a feeling associated with gaining control of your thinking, and it's not something harsh and restrictive, but you know it. You just know it. Mm-hmm. You know, a human mind can understand reality, or the Buddha wouldn't teach it. The only reason why we can't see it is because of fabricated views. And it's those fabricated views that are complicated and difficult to recognize and abandon. It's not the path leading to that recognition. Mm-hmm. I was going to teach some more, but that was a great question. Thank you. Lorna, how are you today?
Good, thank you. Read the sutra at home. When you just read it through, it is a bit wordy. Anyway, been thinking about it since I read it, and I realize that the Buddha starts the sutta with, imagine that we all come to a
guest house,
and we're all living together in a guest house. But really, I think that's really an example of the world. We're all living in this guest house.
Yeah, that's another way to look at it.
We're all living together. I mean, he's just pointing it to something that we can sort of wrap our heads around, but really, it's happening all the time. That's life.
Yeah.
We're all in this guest house together.
Yeah.
And what he's pointing out to me in the sutta is that to live in this guest house peacefully together is the Eightfold Path.
Wow. I like your yeah, like your interpretation is a lot better than the teacher's. Thank you.
Also, he uses the word traveling, and I don't know if the Buddha used the word this way, but in Buddhism, traveling means a fabrication. When your mind goes off and you travel.
Yeah, always.
So he uses the word when we are traveling. Now we could say that we are traveling in that sense as well, that he uses that word, specifically uses that word, and it's probably not a coincidence he uses that word. He's kind of referring to the traveling that we do, which is, not refusing, but to be not in the present. When we're traveling, we're avoiding the present moment.
Yep, right? Exactly.
So there's that kind of light going on in the sutra as well. And you can say sometimes when you catch yourself in a fabrication that you're traveling.
Yeah, you're wandering. Another great translation, because you're wandering in samsara. You're wandering in ignorance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Thank you. Great interpretation, Anthony. Good to see you.
Good morning. There's great power in being able to be in a particular moment that would have in the past gotten you aroused and angered, and being able to sit there as sort of like a impassionate, independent observer. And it even seems a little comical sometimes.
It does. You see the absurdity of the world and of your own proclivities to react. And you've had direct experience of this over and over again now, haven't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just in the last trial I was in, I was able to sit there in moments that I would have gotten very angered or energized by and just be very, you know, matter of fact about it.
Yeah.
And when you could bring that kind of clarity, you actually calm everybody down around you instead of the opposite.
And in a healthy way, you really gain control of the situation.
Yes.
Yeah. And not that you're trying to
force. By doing nothing.
By doing nothing. Not that you're trying to force your will, because now your thoughts, words, and deeds are guided by the Eightfold Path. You can do no harm. You know, that's that great freedom that we start developing it.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be in court. I mean, it could be just being in traffic.
Yeah. It could be watching the evening news, which is really comes in handy when you're watching the news today, to not be reactive.
Yeah. And I'm glad you explained the end of that, because I would have thought that we're always supposed to be dealing with the phenomena that's thrown at us, not creating our own phenomena. I'm glad you explained what that meant, because I would have interpreted that as, well, we don't create a calm mind. We it's something we do to adopt to the phenomena that's being thrown at us.
No, that's really a good point too. Everything that the Buddha teaches is to be developed, including that calm and peaceful mind. And he gave us very simple but specific tools for developing that. And this is one of the really remarkable things that I saw when I started looking at what the Buddha taught, is I realized that up until that point, everything that I was being taught, and it gets pretty subtle at times, everything I was being taught was an abstract, a concept, but no clear path on how to get to that abstract place. The Buddha he used metaphor to make a point, but nothing he taught was abstract, and he says it in the sutta. This is to be directly experienced.
Yeah.
And this is how you directly experience it.
Yeah, so
it's completely different.
Like the big difference is everybody else tells you, here's the place you need to get to.
Yep.
And he says, enjoy your journey.
Yes. And that's that that's the positive thinking bubble that we've all been conditioned to believe in, that just put the ideal out there. Well, what does that do? And we can't live up to that because our minds are still rooted in ignorance. It just increases our self-loathing, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. I don't perform well in the world. I can't do these things that people expect me to be, always happy and smiling and compassionate and loving and honest. Well, if my mind is still rooted in fabrication, no matter how much I want to be that person, I can't. And that was really, that was my ongoing anguish. And I think everybody's, we're most human beings, unless you have a deep-seated psychosis, you want to be like an awakened human being, don't you? You just don't understand. You don't have all the means to do it yet. And it becomes very frustrating and very easy to judge ourselves harshly. And once we start judging ourselves harshly, we're going to judge the world harshly. It's just the way a mind works. And so this is just the opposite. You can develop the most effective human life, everyone can, by simply engaging with the Eightfold Path. And it's just remarkable. And it's just that way. Yeah, you know.
And that's the prize.
That's the prize.
Not where you end up.
Yeah, and isn't it enough? I ask you, and I think I've asked every one of you at one point or another, you describe the benefits of the practice. We're not quite to that awakened state, but it's worth the price of admission, isn't it? It's just a better way to live in the world. Why not? Thank you, Anthony. Eva, good to see you.
John, everyone, very happy to be here. Missed you all.
We missed you.
I am speechless and joyful.
It's good to see you. Mary, good to see you this morning. How are you?
I'm here. All I have to say is I'm Nancy Pelosi, must be a Buddhist.
She seemed a little bit agitated the other day, but maybe she has it.
She certainly did hold it together.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what he says is just so true. If you just stay calm and, you know, say what you need to say, but say it in a calm way and not be reactive, you feel better and everybody around you stays commerce most of the time.
Oh, yeah.
Unless you have a
psychosis. That was an important qualification.
I mean, it's just, I'm going to have to go home and reread this. But it's just, he puts things so simply and so beautifully, and you understand that it's all in here.
Yeah. Thank you, Mary. Can I have 2 minutes of your time after class?
Yeah.
Thank you. Kevin, how are you?
Well,
how's that retreat mind going?
Good. You know, when you come back in the world, boy, you get swept away so quickly.
Yeah.
This sutta, I think, is very direct. It doesn't leave any mystery about what he's talking about. This is the path. This is the problem. This is the solution. This is the path.
Yeah.
He lays it out very clearly. I like, you know, the guest house metaphor too, and I think it's so true that it is the world. This is the guest house for all of it. Mm-hmm. But also I think he means this guest house is this refuge, is this dharma.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we are coming from all different, our lives here today even, and our lives moment by moment, to this guest house, to this refuge, to this dharma. And it will lead us if we take the path.
Yeah. The Buddha is consistent. Thank you. Consistently presenting what he's teaching. Excuse me. as a practical solution to the suffering in the world. It's just that. Dukkha occurs. Here's a way to understand it and live to flourish in your life. Despite whatever conditions are going on, it doesn't matter. And it works. Anybody can do it. It's just remarkable. Something else I wanted to add to this, but I guess that's enough. Huh? This thing I was talking about before, understanding or knowing that you have control of your mind in each moment is really the point of the Dhamma, not just having it, but knowing that you've done it, that you're able to do that. And so would every one of you say that you've developed at least a measure of that, of you're regaining control of your mind?
Mm-hmm.
And it is palpable. You know it, don't you? You might be even a little surprised in a situation that you would have normally lost your mind and you didn't. That's concentration. That's the value of a well-concentrated mind. So wouldn't it make sense that the Buddha would teach a meditation practice that does just that? And why would he teach anything else? Because it doesn't relate. He would say this. I don't teach these other things, including alternate so-called meditation practices, because they don't lead to the goal of understanding suffering. And it really is that simple. And it helps us to keep a useful focus, a skillful focus, and not try to adapt and accommodate and embellish our Dhamma practices because something feels good. Keep it pure. All right, we'll finish with metta as we always do. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. For a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.